Crossroads of Twilight by Robert Jordan. This book is read by Michael Kramer and Kate Redding. Dedication for Harriet, then, now, and always. And it shall come to pass, in the days when the dark hunt rides, when the right hand falters and the left hand strays, that mankind shall come to the crossroads of twilight, and all that is, all that was, and all that will be shall balance on the point of a sword, while the winds of the shadow grow. From the Prophecies of the Dragon, translation believed done by Jane Charin, known as Jane Farstrider, shortly before his disappearance. Prologue. Glimmers of the Pattern. Rhoda Littoralda hated waiting, though he knew well it was the largest part of being a soldier. Waiting for the next battle, for the enemy to move, to make a mistake. He watched the winter forest and was as still as the trees. The sun stood halfway to its peak and gave no warmth. His breath misted white in front of his face, frosting his neatly trimmed mustache and the black fox fur lining his hood. He was glad that his helmet hung at his pommel. His breastplate held the cold and radiated it through his coat and all the layers of wool, silk, and linen beneath. Even Dart's saddle felt cold, as though the white gelding were made of frozen milk. The helmet would have addled his brain. Winter had come late to Arad Domann, very late, but with a vengeance. From summer heat that lingered unnaturally into fall, to winter's heart in less than a month. The leaves that had survived the long summer's drought had been frozen before they could change color, and now they glistened like strange ice-covered emeralds in the morning sun. The horses of the 20-odd armsmen around him occasionally stamped a hoof in the knee-deep snow. It had been a long ride this far, and they had farther to go, whether this day turned out good or ill. Dark clouds roiled the sky to northward. He did not need his weatherwise there to tell him the temperature would plummet before nightfall. They had to be under shelter by then.
"Not as rough as winter before last, is it, my lord?" Jollum said quietly.
The tall young officer had a way of reading Iteralda's mind, and his voice was pitched for the others to hear.
"Even so, I suppose some men would be dreaming of mulled wine about now. Not this lot, of course. Remarkably abstemious. They all drink tea, I believe. Cold tea. If they had a few birch switches, they'd be stripping down for snow baths."
"They'll have to keep their clothes on for the time being," Iteralda replied dryly. "But they might get some cold tea tonight, if they're lucky."
That brought a few chuckles. Quiet chuckles. He had chosen these men with care, and they knew about noise at the wrong time. He himself could have done with a steaming cup of spiced wine or even tea, but it was a long time since merchants had brought tea to Arad Domann. A long time since any outland merchant had ventured farther than the border of Saldea. By the time news of the outside world reached him, it was as stale as last month's bread, if it was more than rumor to begin. That hardly mattered, though. If the White Tower truly was divided against itself, or men who could channel really were being called to Camelin, well, the world would have to do without Rhoda Littoralda until Arad Domann was whole again. For the moment, Arad Domann was more than enough for any sane man to go on with. Once again he reviewed the orders he had sent, carried by the fastest riders he had, to every noble loyal to the king. Divided as they were by bad blood and old feuds, they still shared that much. They would gather their armies and ride when orders came from the wolf, at least so long as he held the king's favor. They would even hide in the mountains and wait at his order. Oh, they would chafe, and some would curse his name, but they would obey. They knew the wolf won battles. More, they knew he won wars. The little wolf, they called him, when they thought he could not hear, but he did not care whether they drew attention to his stature. Well, not much, so long as they rode when and where he said. Very soon they would be riding hard, moving to set a trap that would not spring for months. It was a long chance he was taking. Complex plans had many ways to fall apart, and this plan had layers inside layers. Everything would be ruined before it began, if he failed to provide the bait, or if someone ignored his order to evade couriers from the king. They all knew his reasons, though, and even the most stiff-necked shared them, though few were willing to speak of the matter aloud. He himself had moved like a wraith racing on a storm since he received Al-Salam's latest command. In his sleeve, where the folded paper lay tucked above the pale lace that fell onto his steel-backed gauntlet. They had one last chance, one very small chance, to save Arad-Daman. Perhaps even to save Al-Salam from himself before the Council of Merchants decided to put another man on the throne in his place. He had been a good ruler for over 20 years. The light send that he could be again. A loud crack to the south sent Iteralda's hand to the hilt of his longsword. There was a faint creak of leather and metal as others eased their weapons. For the rest, silence. The forest was as still as a frozen tomb. Only a limb breaking under the weight of snow. After a moment he let himself relax, as much as he had relaxed since the tales came north of the Dragon Reborn appearing in the sky at Falma. Perhaps the man really was the Dragon Reborn. Perhaps he really had appeared in the sky. But whatever the truth, those tales had set Arad-Daman on fire. Iteralda was sure he could have put out that fire, given a freer hand. It was not boasting to think so. He knew what he could do, with a battle, a campaign, or a war. But ever since the council had decided the king would be safer smuggled out of Bandar-Eban, Al-Salam seemed to have taken into his head that he was the rebirth of Artur Hawkwing. His signature and seal had marked scores of battle orders since, flooding out from wherever the council had him hidden. They would not say where that was, even to Iteralda himself. Every woman on the council that he confronted went flat-eyed and evasive at any mention of the king. He could almost believe they did not know where Al-Salam was. A ridiculous thought, of course. The council kept an unblinking eye on the king. Iteralda had always believed the merchant houses interfered too much, yet he wished they would interfere now. Why they remained silent was a mystery, for a king who damaged trade did not remain long on the throne. He was loyal to his oaths, and Al-Salam was a friend besides, but the orders the king sent could not have been better written to achieve chaos. Nor could they be ignored. Al-Salam was the king, but he had commanded Iteralda to march north with all possible speed against a great gathering of dragonsworn that Al-Salam supposedly knew of from secret spies. Then, 10 days later, with no dragonsworn yet in sight, an order came to move south again, with all possible speed, against another gathering that never materialized. He had been commanded to concentrate his forces to defend Bandar-Eban when a 3-pronged attack might have ended it all, and to divide them when a hammer blow could have done the same, to harry ground he knew the Dragonsworn had abandoned, and to march away from where he knew they camped. Worse, Al-Salam's orders often had gone directly to the powerful nobles who were supposed to be following Iteralda, sending Machir in this direction, Teyakal in that, Rahman in a third. 4 times pitched battles had resulted from parts of the army blundering into one another in the night while moving to the king's express command and expecting none but enemies ahead. And all the while the Dragonsworn gained numbers and confidence. Iteralda had had his triumphs at Salanja and Messine, at Lake Somal and Kandalmar. The lords of Qatar had learned not to sell the products of their mines and forges to the enemies of Arad-Daman, but always Al-Salam's orders wasted his gains. This last order was different, though. For one thing, a gray man had killed Lady Tuva trying to stop it from reaching him. Why the Shadow might fear this order more than any other was a mystery, yet it was all the more reason to move swiftly, before Al-Salam reached him with another. This order opened many possibilities, and he had considered every last one he could see. But the good ones all started here, today. When small chances of success were all that remained, you had to seize them. A snow jay's strident cry rang out in the distance, then a second time, a third. Cupping his hands around his mouth, Iteralda repeated the 3 harsh calls. Moments later, a shaggy, pale, dapple gelding appeared out of the trees, his rider in a white cloak streaked with black. Man and horse alike would have been hard to see in the snowy forest had they been standing still. The rider pulled up beside Iteralda. A stocky man, he wore a single sword with a short blade, and there were a cased bow and a quiver fastened to his saddle.
"Looks like they all came, my lord," he said in his permanently hoarse voice, pushing his cowl back from his head.
Someone had tried to hang Don Jell when he was young, though the reason was lost in the years. What remained of his short-cropped hair was iron-gray. The dark leather patch covering the socket of his right eye was a remnant of another youthful scrape. One eye or two, though, he was the best scout Iteralda had ever known.
"Most, anyways," he went on. "They put 2 rings of sentries around the lodge, one inside the other. You can see them a mile off, but nobody will get close without them at the lodge hearing of it in time to get away. By the tracks, they didn't bring no more men than you said they could. Not enough to count. Course," he added wryly, That still leaves you outnumbered a fair bit.
Iteralda nodded. He had offered the white ribbon, and the men he was to meet had accepted. 3 days when men pledged under the light by their souls in hope of salvation not to draw a weapon against another or shed blood. The white ribbon had not been tested in this war, however, and these days some men had strange ideas of where salvation lay. Those who called themselves Dragonsworn, for instance. He had always been called a gambler, though he was not. The trick was in knowing what risks you could take, and sometimes in knowing which ones you had to take. Pulling a packet sewn into oiled silk from his boot top, he handed it to Donjell.
If I don't reach Corn Ford in 2 days, take this to my wife.
The scout tucked the packet somewhere beneath his cloak, touched his forehead, and turned his horse west. He had carried its like for Iteralda before, usually on the eve of battle. The light said this was not the time Tamsin would have to open that packet. She would come after him, she had told him so. The first incident ever of the living haunting the dead.
Jalam, Iteralda said, let us see what waits at Lady Osana's hunting lodge.
As he heeled dart forward, the others fell in behind him. The sun rose to its height and began again to descend as they rode. The dark clouds in the north moved closer and the chill bit deeper. There was no sound but the crunch of hooves breaking through the snow crust. The forest seemed empty, save for themselves. He did not see any of the sentries Donjell had spoken of. The man's opinion of what could be seen from a mile differed from that of most. They would be expecting him, of course, and watching to make sure he was not followed by an army, white ribbon or no white ribbon. A good many of them likely had reasons they felt sufficient to feather Rodolai Teralda with arrows. A lord might pledge the white ribbon for his men, but would all of those feel bound? Sometimes there were chances you just had to take. About mid-afternoon, Osana's so-called hunting lodge loomed suddenly out of the trees, a mass of pale towers and slender, pointed domes that would have fitted well among the palaces of Bandar Iban itself. Her hunting had always been for men or power, her trophies numerous and noteworthy despite her relative youth, and the hunts that had taken place here would have raised eyebrows even in the capital. The lodge lay desolate now. Broken windows gaped like mouths with jagged teeth. None showed a glimmer of light or movement. The snow covering the cleared ground around the lodge had been well trampled by horses, however. The ornate, brass-bound gates of the main courtyard stood open, and he rode through without slowing, followed by his men. The horses' hooves clattered on the paving stones, where the snow had been beaten to slush. No servants came out to greet him, not that he had expected any. Osana had vanished early in the troubles that now shook Ara-Daman, like a dog shaking a rat, and her servants had drifted quickly to others of her house, taking whatever places they could find. These days the masterless starved or turned bandit, or dragon-sworn. Dismounting in front of the broad marble stairway at the end of the courtyard, he handed Dart's reins to one of his armsmen, and Jalam ordered the men to take shelter where they could find it for themselves and the animals. Eyeing the marble balconies and wide windows that surrounded the courtyard, they moved as if expecting a crossbow bolt between the shoulder blades. One set of stable doors stood slightly ajar, but in spite of the cold, they divided themselves between the corners of the courtyard, huddling with the horses where they could keep watch in every direction. If the worst came, perhaps a few might make it out. Removing his gauntlets, he tucked them behind his belt and checked his lace as he climbed the stairs with Jalam. Snow, that had been trodden underfoot and frozen again, crackled beneath his boots. He refrained from looking anywhere but straight ahead. He must appear supremely assured, as though there were no possibility events should go other than as he expected. Confidence was one key to victory. The other side believing you were confident was sometimes almost as good as actually being confident. At the head of the stairs, Jalam pulled open one of the tall carved doors by its gilded ring. Iteralda touched his beauty spot with a finger to make sure it was in place. His cheeks were too cold to feel the black velvet star clinging before he stepped inside, as self-assured as he would have been at a ball. The cavernous entry hall was as icy as the outside. Their breath made feathered mists. Unlit, the space seemed already wreathed in twilight. The floor was a colorful mosaic of hunters and animals, the tiles chipped in places, as though heavy weights had been dragged over them, or perhaps dropped. Aside from a single toppled plinth that might once have held a large vase or a small statue, the hall was bare. What the servants had not taken when they fled had long since been looted by bandits. A single man awaited them, white-haired and more gaunt than when Iteralda had last seen him. His breastplate was battered, and his earring was just a small gold hoop, but his lace was immaculate, and the sparkling red quarter moon beside his left eye would have gone well at court in better times.
"By the light, be welcome under the white ribbon, Lord Iteralda," he said formally with a slight bow.
"By the light, I come under the white ribbon, Lord Shimron," Iteralda replied, making his courtesy in return. Shimron had been one of Al-Salam's most trusted advisers, until he joined the Dragon Sworn, at least. Now he stood high in their councils. "My armsman is Jalam Nishur, honor-bound to House Iteralda, as are all who came with me." There had been no House Iteralda before, Rodal, but Shimron answered Jalam's bow, hand to heart.
"Honor be to honor. Will you accompany me, Lord Iteralda?"
he said as he straightened. The great doors to the ballroom were gone from their hinges, though Iteralda could hardly imagine bandits looting those. They left a tall, pointed arch, wide enough for 10 men to pass. Within the windowless oval room, 50 lanterns of every size and sort beat its shadows, though the light barely reached the domed ceiling. Separated by a wide expanse of floor, 2 groups of men stood against the painted walls, and if the white ribbon had induced them to leave off helmets, all 200 or more were armored otherwise, and certainly no one had put aside his swords. To one side were a few Domani lords as powerful as Shimron, Rajabi, Wakeda, Ankar, each surrounded by his cluster of lesser lords and sworn commoners, and smaller clusters, of few as 2 or 3, many containing no nobles at all. The Dragon Sworn had councils, but no one commander. Still, each of those men was a leader in his own right, some counting their followers in scores, a few in thousands. None appeared happy to be where he was, and 1 or 2 shot glares across the floor to where 50 or 60 Terrabanners stood, in one solid mass, and scowled back. Dragon Sworn they might all be, yet there was little love lost between Domani and Terrabanners. Iteralda almost smiled at the sight of the outlanders, though. He had not dared to count on half so many appearing today.
"Lord Rodal Iteralda comes under the white ribbon,"
Shimron's voice rang through the lantern shadows.
"Let whoever may think of violence search his heart and consider his soul."
And that was the end of formality.
"Why does Lord Iteralda offer the white ribbon?"
Wakeda demanded, one hand gripping the hilt of his longsword and the other in a fist at his side. He was not a tall man, though taller than Iteralda, but as haughty as if he held the throne himself. Women had called him beautiful once. Now a slanting black scarf covered the socket of his missing right eye, and his beauty spot was a black arrowhead pointing at the thick scar running from his cheek up onto his forehead.
"Does he intend to join us, or ask us to surrender? All know the wolf is bold as well as devious. Is he that bold?"
A rumble rose among the men on his side of the room, part mirth, part anger. Iteralda clasped his hands behind his back to keep from fingering the ruby in his left ear. That was widely known as a sign that he was angry, and sometimes he did it on purpose, but he needed to present a calm face now, even while the man spoke past his ear. No, calm. Duels were entered into in anger, but he was here to fight a duel, and that required calm. Words could be deadlier weapons than swords.
"Every man here knows we have another enemy to the south," he said in a steady voice. "The Shanchan have swallowed Taraban."
He ran his gaze over the Terrabanners and met flat stares. He never had been able to read Terrabanners' faces. Between those preposterous mustaches, like hairy tusks, worse than a Soldaian's, and those ridiculous veils, they might as well wear masks, and the poor light from the lanterns did not help. But he had seen them veiled in mail, and he needed them.
"They have flooded onto Almuth Plain and moved ever north. Their intent is clear. They mean to have Arad Daman, too. They mean to have the whole world, I fear. Does Lord Iteralda want to know who we will support if these Shanchan invade us?"
Wakeda demanded.
"I have true faith you will fight for Arad Daman, Lord Wakeda," Iteralda said mildly.
Wakeda went purple at having the direct insult flung in his teeth, and his oathmen's hands went to hilts.
"Refugees have brought word that there are Aiel on the plain now,"
Shimron put in quickly, as though he feared Wakeda might break the white ribbon. None of Wakeda's oathmen would draw steel unless he did, or commanded them to.
"They fight for the dragon reborn, so say the reports. He must have sent them, perhaps as an aid to us. No one has ever defeated an Aiel army, not even Otter Hawkwing. You recall the blood snow, Lord Aetherelda, when we were younger? I believe you agree with me that we did not defeat them there, whatever the histories may say. And I cannot believe the Seanchan have the numbers we did then. I myself have heard of Seanchan moving south, away from the border. No, I suspect the next we hear will be of them retreating from the plain, not advancing on us.
He was not a bad commander in the field, but he had always been pedantic. Aetherelda smiled. Word came more swiftly from the south than from anywhere else, but he had been afraid he would have to bring up the Aiel, and they might have thought he was trying to trick them. He could hardly believe it himself, Aiel on Almuth Plain. He did not point out that Aiel sent to help the Dragonsworn were more likely to have appeared in Arad-Daman itself.
I have questioned refugees, too, and they speak of Aiel raids, not armies. Whatever the Aiel are doing on the plain may have slowed the Seanchan, but it hasn't turned them back. Their flying beasts have begun scouting on our side of the border. That does not smack of retreat.
Producing the paper from his sleeve with a flourish, he held it up so all could see the sword in hand impressed in green and blue wax. As always of late, he had used a hot blade to separate the royal seal on one side while leaving it whole, so he could show it unbroken to doubters. There had been plenty of those when they heard some of Al-Salam's orders.
I have orders from King Al-Salam to gather as many men as I can, from wherever I can find them, and strike as hard as I can at the Seanchan.
He took a deep breath. Here he took another chance, and Al-Salam might have his head on the block unless the dice fell the right way.
I offer a truce. I pledge in the king's name not to move against you in any way, so long as the Seanchan remain a threat to Arad-Daman. If you will all pledge the same and fight beside me against them, until they are beaten back.
A stunned silence answered him. Bull-necked Rajabi appeared pole-axed. Wakeda chewed his lip like a startled girl. Then Shimron muttered,
Can they be beaten back, Lord Aetherelda? I faced there. They're chained Aes Sedai on Almuth Plain as did you.
Boots scraped the floor as men shifted their feet and faces darkened in bleak anger. No man liked to think he was helpless before an enemy, but enough had been there in the early days, with Aetherelda and Shimron, for all to know what this enemy was like.
They can be defeated, Lord Shimron, Aetherelda replied, even with their little surprises.
A strange thing to call the earth erupting under your feet, and scouts that rode what looked like shadow spawn, but he had to sound assured as well as look it. Besides, when you knew what the enemy could do, you adapted. That had been one core of warfare long before the Seanchan appeared. Darkness cut the Seanchan advantages, and so did storms, and a weatherwise could always tell you when a storm was coming.
A wise man stops chewing when he reaches bone, he continued, but so far the Seanchan have had their meat sliced thin before they reached for it. I intend to give them a tough shank to gnaw. More, I have a plan to make them snap so fast they'll break their teeth on bone before they have a mouthful of meat. Now, I have pledged. Will you?
It was hard not to hold his breath. Each man seemed to be looking inward. He could all but see them mulling it over. The wolf had a plan. The Seanchan had chained Aes Sedai and flying beasts, and the light alone knew what else. But the wolf had a plan. The Seanchan, the wolf.
If any man can defeat them, Shimron said finally, you can, Lord Aetherelda. I will so pledge.
I do so pledge, Rajabi shouted. We'll chase them back across the ocean where they came from.
He had a bull's temperament as well as its neck. Surprisingly, Wakeda thundered his agreement with equal enthusiasm, and then a storm of voices broke, calling that they would match the king's pledge, that they would smash the Seanchan, even some that they would follow the wolf into the pit of doom. All very gratifying, but not all Aetherelda had come for.
If you ask us to fight for Arad-Daman, one voice shouted above the rest, then ask us.
The men who had been calling their pledges fell to angry mutters and half-heard curses. Hiding his pleasure behind a bland expression, Aetherelda turned to face the speaker on the other side of the room. The Terrabanner was a lean man, with a sharp nose that made a tent of his veil. His eyes were hard, though, and keen. Some of the other Terrabanners frowned as if displeased he had spoken, so it appeared they had no one leader any more than the Domani. But he had spoken. Iteralda had hoped for the pledges he had received, but they were not necessary to his plan. The Terrabonners were. At least, they would make it 100 times more likely to work. He addressed the man courteously with a bow.
I offer you the chance to fight for Terrabon, my good lord. The Aiel are making some confusion on the plain. The refugees speak of it. Tell me, could a small company of your men, 100, perhaps 2, cross the plain in that disorder and enter Terrabon, if their armor was marked with stripes, as those who ride for the Shonchan?
It seemed impossible the Terrabonner's face could grow any tighter, yet it did, and it was the turn of the men on his side of the room to mutter angrily and curse. Enough word had come north for them to know of a king and panarch put on their thrones by the Shonchan, and swearing fealty to an empress on the other side of the Arath Ocean. They could not like reminders of how many of their countrymen now rode for this empress. Most of the Shonchan on Almuth Plain were Terrabonners.
What good could one small company do? The lean man growled contemptuous.
Little good, Iteralda replied. But if there were 50 such companies, 100? These Terrabonners might have that many men behind them, all told.
If they all struck on the same day, all across Terrabon, I myself would ride with them, and as many of my men as can be outfitted in Terrabonner armor. Just so you will know, this is not simply a stratagem to get rid of you.
Behind him, the Domani began protesting loudly. Wakeda the loudest of all, if it could be believed. The wolf's plan was all very well, but they wanted the wolf himself at their head. Most of the Terrabonners began arguing among themselves over whether so many men could cross the plain without being discovered, even in such small bands, over what good, if any, they could do in Terrabon in small companies, over whether they were willing to wear armor marked with Shonchan stripes. Terrabonners argued as easily as Saldaeans, and as hotly. Not the sharp-nosed man. He met Iteralda's gaze steadily, then gave a slight nod. It was hard to tell behind those thick mustaches, but Iteralda thought he smiled. The last tension faded from Iteralda's shoulders. The fellow would not have agreed while the others argued, if he were not more of a leader among them than he seemed. The others would come too, he was certain. They would ride south with him into the heart of what the Shonchan considered their own, and slap them hard and full across the face. The Terrabonners would want to stay afterward, of course, and continue the fight in their own homeland. He could not expect anything more. Which would leave him and the few thousand men he could take with him to be hounded back north again, all the long way across Almuth Plain. If the light shone on him, hounded with fury. He returned the Terrabonner's smile, if smile it was. With any luck, furious generals would not see where he was leading them until it was too late. And if they did, well, he had a second plan. Eamon Valde held his cloak tight around himself as he tramped through the snow among the trees. Cold and steady, the wind sighed through the snow-laden branches, a deceptively quiet sound in the damp gray light. It sliced through the thick white wool as through gauze, chilling him to the bone. The camp sprawling around him through the forest was too quiet. Movement provided a little warmth, but in this, men huddled together unless driven to move. Abruptly, he stopped in his tracks, wrinkling his nose at a sudden stench, a gagging foulness like 20 midden heaps crawling with maggots. He did not gag, instead he scowled. The camp lacked the precision he preferred. The tents were clustered haphazardly, wherever the limbs overhead grew thickest, the horses tethered close by, rather than properly picketed. It was the sort of slackness that led to filth. Unwatched, the men would bury horse dung under a few shovels of dirt to be done with it quicker, and dig latrines where they would not have to walk far in the cold. Any officer of his who allowed that would cease to be an officer and learn firsthand how to use a shovel. He was scanning the camp for the source of the smell when suddenly there was no smell. The wind did not change. The stink just vanished. He was startled for only a moment. Walking on, he scowled all the harder. The stench had come from somewhere. He would find whoever thought discipline had slackened and make examples of them. Discipline had to be tight now, tighter than ever. At the edge of a broad clearing, he paused again. The snow in the clearing was smooth and unmarked, despite the camp hidden all around it. Staying back among the trees, he scanned the sky. Scudding gray clouds hid the noonday sun. A flicker of motion made his breath catch before he realized it was just a bird, some small brown thing, wary of hawks and staying low. He barked a laugh that was more than touched with bitterness. Little more than a month since the light-cursed Shonchen had swallowed Amador and the Fortress of Light in one unbelievable gulp, but he had learned new instincts. Wise men learned, while fools... Aelron had been a fool, puffed up with old tales of glory, brightened by age and new hope of winning real power to go with his crown. He refused to see the reality in front of his eyes, and Aelron's disaster had been the result. Balda had heard it named the Battle of Jeramel, but only by some of the bare handful of Amadisian nobles who escaped, dazed as poleaxed steers, yet still trying mechanically to put the best face on events. He wondered what Aelron had called it when the Shonchan's tame witches began tearing his orderly ranks to bloody rags. He could still see that in his head, the earth turning to fountains of fire. He saw it in his dreams. Well, Aelron was dead, cut down trying to flee the field, and his head displayed on a Terrabanner's lance. A suitable death for a fool. He, on the other hand, had over 9,000 of the children gathered around him. A man who saw clearly could make much out of that in times like these. On the far side of the clearing, just inside the tree line, was a rude house that had once belonged to a charcoal burner, a single room with winter-brown weeds thick in the gaps between the stones. By all appearances, the man had abandoned the place some time ago. Parts of the thatch roof sagged dangerously, and whatever had once filled the narrow windows was long since gone, replaced now by dark blankets. Two guards stood beside the ill-fitting wooden door, big men with the scarlet shepherd's crook behind the golden sunflare on their cloaks. They had their arms wrapped around themselves and were stamping their boots against the cold. Neither could have reached his sword in time to do any good, had Valda been an enemy. Questioners liked to work indoors. Their faces might have been carved stone as they watched him approach. Neither offered more than a half-hearted salute. Not for a man without the shepherd's crook, even if he was Lord Captain Commander of the Children. One opened his mouth as if to question Valda's purpose, but Valda walked by them and pushed open the rough door. At least they did not try to stop him. He would have killed them both if they had. At his entrance, Asinawa looked up from the crooked table where he was perusing a small book, one bony hand cupped around a steaming pewter cup that gave off the odor of spices. His ladder-back chair, the only other piece of furniture in the room, appeared rickety, but someone had strengthened it with rawhide lashings. Valda tightened his mouth to stop a sneer. The High Inquisitor of the Hand of the Light demanded a real roof, not a tent, even if it was thatch sorely in need of patching, and mulled wine when no one else had tasted wine of any sort in a week. A small fire burned on the stone hearth, too, giving a meager warmth. Even cook fires had been banned since before the disaster, to prevent smoke giving them away. Still, although most children despised the questioners, they held Asinawa in a strange esteem, as if his gray hair and gaunt martyr's face graced him with all the ideals of the Children of the Light. That had been a surprise when Valda first learned of it. He was unsure whether Asinawa himself knew. In any case, there were enough questioners to make trouble. Nothing he could not handle, but it was best to avoid that sort of trouble. For now. "It is almost time," he said, shutting the door behind him. "Are you ready?" Asinawa made no move to rise or reach for the white cloak folded across the table beside him. There was no sun flare on that, just the scarlet crook. Instead, he folded his hands over the book, hiding the pages. Valda thought it was Mantellar's The Way of the Light. Odd reading for the High Inquisitor, more suited to new recruits. Those who could not read when they swore were taught so they could study Mantellar's words. "I have reports of an Andoran army in Murundi, my son," Asinawa said. "Deep in Murundi, perhaps."
"Murundi is a long way from here," Valda said, as though he did not recognize an old argument starting anew, an argument that Asinawa often seemed to forget he had already lost.
But what were Andorans doing in Murundi?
If the reports were true, so many were travelers' fantasies wrapped in lies. Andor, the very name rankled in Valda's memory. Morghese was dead, or else a servant to some Shonchen. They had little respect for titles other than their own. Dead or a servant, she was lost to him, and more important by far, his plans for Andor were lost. Galadriel had gone from a useful lever to just another young officer, and one who was too popular with the common soldiers. Good officers were never popular, but Valda was a pragmatic man. The past was the past. New plans had replaced Andor.
Not so far if we move east across Altara, my son, across the north of Altara. The Shanshan cannot have moved far from Ebudar yet.
Spreading his hands to catch the hearth fire's small warmth, Valda sighed. They had spread like a plague in Terabon, and here in Amadicia. Why did the men think Altara was different?
Are you forgetting the witches in Altara? With an army of their own, need I remind you? Unless they're into Murundi by now.
Those reports, he believed, of the witches on the move. In spite of himself, his voice rose.
Maybe this so-called Andoran army you've heard about is the witches and their army. They gave Camelon to Althor, remember? And Ilion, and half the east. Do you really believe the witches are divided? Do you?
Slowly he drew a deep breath, calming himself. Trying to. Every tale out of the east was worse than the last. A gust of wind down the chimney blew sparks into the room, and he stepped back with a curse. Bloody peasant hovel. Even the chimney was ill-made. Asunawa snapped the small book shut between his palms. His hands were folded as in prayer, but his deep-set eyes suddenly seemed hotter than the fire.
I believe the witches must be destroyed. That is what I believe.
I'd settle for knowing how the Shanshan tamed them.
With enough tame witches, he could drive Althor out of Andor, out of Ilion, and everywhere else he had settled like the Shadow itself. He could better Hawkwing himself.
They must be destroyed, Asunawa asserted stubbornly.
And us with them, Valda demanded.
A knock came at the door, and at Asanawa's curt summons, one of the guards from outside appeared in the doorway, standing rigidly erect, arm snapping across his chest in a crisp salute.
My Lord High Inquisitor, he said respectfully, the Council of the Anointed is here.
Valda waited. Would the old fool continue to be stubborn with all 10 surviving lords captain outside, mounted and ready to ride? What was done was done. What had to be done?
If it brings down the White Tower, Asunawa said finally, I can be content. For now. I will come to this meeting.
Valda smiled thinly.
Then I am content. We will see the witches fall together.
Certainly he would see them fall.
I suggest you have your horse readied. We have a long way to ride by nightfall.
Whether Asunawa would see it with him was another matter.